Okay, deputy, do we have the next attorneys?
Double burden.
Thank you. Can you call the sheriff's office and tell them that we had the hearing and you missed it?
Do you need them?
Next, may be seated. The next case on the calendar is the case of Els versus Auto Owners Insurance Group, 819-0650. And each counsel will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you begin your argument at the podium, would you please state your name for the record? Everything's being recorded. So if the attorney for the opponent is ready to proceed, can proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacob Burkholz, and I'm the attorney representing plaintiff appellant Kyle Wendell Els. This case comes before this court on a variety of errors in the district court after a trial. There's a multiple day trial that hinged primarily on liability, fact pattern. I know we're short on time and a lot of alleged errors. So I'll try and go quickly through the facts and how we got here. I was underlying counsel in the arson trial. There was acquittal, moved into a breach of contract case and a breach of cooperation clause, which becomes important in the case as to the interplay between the two fires. So that's a bit complicated. The state never charged on fire one. The attorney for auto owners in that case, in his defense, argued that fire one was relevant because if fire one, which there was no evidence argument, Mr. Ellis started that fire, was also relevant due to the issue that he started fire two. And that's relevant because of the damages alleged in the claim and the errors in this claim. And I think that's not very well pointed out necessarily in the pleadings or the arguments. I think it's important both as to the jury instructions and to the claimed errors. Ultimately, we get through the trial and the multiple day trial, and the court very quickly at the end of the trial, when there's a discussion of jury instructions after the evidence, again, there's a long lead up to this, denies any jury instructions on damages to the home. That's a primary error alleged in the case for concern of this court. So a directed verdict gets entered against Mr. Els, essentially orally during the trial, and no jury instructions at all, both on total loss or actual cash value. And it appeared to hinge, there's a variety of pre and motions and arguments trying to create the record and arguments through the trial. I want to make sure that the court in its post-trial motions that, and one glaring oversight of both attorneys, of course, was the admission of auto owners to the issue of total loss that was never raised until after trial. Interestingly, they looked at the complaint in the middle of the trial, but didn't look at the answer. And I guess you could point out both counsel for that, not pointing that out during the trial, but it was raised post-trial within the timings for the new trial. The court seemed to hinge on implicit, an argument of some sort of implicit trial on that issue. I take issue with that, of course, under that rule, and I'll start perhaps there by saying, no, this was litigated prior to the trial, was never raised, essentially raised about 5 days prior to the trial by...
Will you acknowledge, and I'm just going to jump into some of my questions, because I know there are a lot of issues here. Will you acknowledge that as the insurer, your client had the duty or the burden of proving that coverage exists for the claim losses?
Correct.
And so would have the burden of proving, under whichever way you calculate the damage, whether it's the argument that the home was a total loss as a result of the two fires, or proving the other measures of damage, that would have been on your client to do that.
Correct. Okay. But for the admission, yes.
Right. And you acknowledged also, it seems to me that part of this had to do with late disclosure of witnesses. And do you believe that a district court has the discretion to fashion a remedy, including exclusion of witnesses, if they weren't timely disclosed pursuant to a scheduling order?
Generally, yes, but the remedy on that abuse of discretion standard falls into where still is a claimed error in this case because there was no prejudice to auto owners. That falls back. That was briefed in a fairly extensive memo done over the weekend just prior to trial based on the rulings on Friday.
Did you ask for a trial continuous at that point?
A bifurcation was requested on that motion. So it was a very lengthy motion. It actually was essentially kind of not ruled on, sort of ruled on. And the court kind of said, well, I have the abuse of discretion, I'm going to deny it, because the court really didn't reach that issue and said, well, we need the liability to go forward anyway. I mean, the actual damages of the trial was like one of the four days. So the judge says, well, we got liability to deal with, and I'm not going to bifurcate. But yes, there was a request made for bifurcation due to the issue being raised both with Kate Bonick and Tim Paulson as to that alleged late disclosure, but the complaint of the late disclosure doesn't get raised until just days before trial.
And typically with bifurcation, you do liability and depending upon the jury's verdict, then you move right into damages. So are you saying that bifurcation, that your motion or request for bifurcation was in actuality a request for continuance?
Essentially, yes, if you look at my pleadings. I mean, I think it was clearly argued to the court that we're, because of all of the issues raised and arguments raised about disclosure, and I think there's no dispute. I think it's an extreme remedy, but within the district court's discretion to exclude witnesses. And I think for a late notified, I think if you put the argument in context for the entire court's reasoning for the exclusion is essentially faulty. The court just said, you violated Rule 26 and you're going to exclude it. Really didn't provide a detailed analysis, lack of findings as to whether or not there's any prejudice to auto owners. I raised that at the time. Court doesn't make an order, doesn't make a clear finding on that. Not even think enough for this court. I raised that again in the bifurcation because, again, it gets hinted that Kate Bonick can't come either, even though she was disclosed. That gets very detailed in my analysis in my pre-trial, right before the trial, memorandum.
Do you on appeal directly challenge the district court's exclusion of the expert testimony?
I looked at that, if I made a very clear heading to that, but I would say yes. I mean,
I thought you were challenging the judgment as a matter of law on the issue of the dwelling and the damages for the dwelling, but I don't see a challenge to the exclusion of the expert testimony.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that falls into my point three. The argument is if there is an error in the exclusion, it has to be, what's the remedy? So the way I categorized it was based on these variety of incorrect standards, procedural and evidentiary rulings in the trial was necessary. There were so many rulings that happened over a period of time, both with Bonick, both with the bifurcation, in the middle of the trial, the court reversed itself on Mr. Else's testimony. You can't testify, then you can testify after I filed my ruling, my memorandum. And then reversed itself in the middle of Mr. Else's testimony. You can testify only to the damage amount, but not to the repair cost. And then the court held that against plaintiff after ruling that. I tried to have a bench conference, and I said, Your Honor, you told me I couldn't ask that question, and then says I failed to prove it by failing to ask the question when he ruled directly against plaintiff not to ask the question. So plaintiff was directly penalized, and that's in the post-trial finding order, by essentially saying, well, you didn't prove your case. Well, the court excluded Mr. Ellis from testifying to repair costs of any kind, and then said, well, you didn't testify to repair costs. And I said, well, we tried to offer it.
Do you agree that Mr. Ellis didn't testify to the cost to repair or replace the damaged portion of the house?
That was excluded.
So he testified to the value of the house itself, but not to the cost to repair or replace the damaged portion of the house?
Yes, so that was raised, brought, and was litigated orally in front of the court at the time Mr. Ellis testified. And the court said, I'm not allowing him to testify to that.
But did he have repair estimates and things like that, which one would expect to have to offer testimony about the repair costs? This is a situation where there had been no repairs at the time of the trial.
Right. He is by trade and a skilled house builder, home remodeler himself, but no, he did not have a particular invoice off to the court.
And he didn't offer any testimony as to whether the damaged portion of the house could be safely rebuilt in terms of whether it was a total loss, correct?
Again, he's excluded from testifying, so yes.
And to that issue about whether expert testimony is necessary to demonstrate a total loss, in your reply brief, you state that a jury only needs expert testimony on matters that are not of common knowledge to the jury, or a jury. That's page 6 of your reply brief. So isn't whether a home can be safely rebuilt after a fire, isn't that something that is outside of the common knowledge of a jury? I'm having trouble understanding why that doesn't require specialized knowledge and expertise.
So I think it falls again back to the owner exception that the Supreme Court rules of an owner can testify to their own property and the knowledge of their own property.
But did the Supreme Court hold that an owner can testify as to whether a home can be safely rebuilt through construction methods?
I don't think that's ever been laid out clearly in any case that I could find, that particular issue on that narrow of a holding, whether or not if there's any. I think that this was argued orally very extensively of whether or not, as auto owner puts it, if there was one stick standing, I think was the argument of counsel, opposing counsel, was one stick standing, could it be safely rebuilt, required expert testimony?
Yeah. Well, here the picture of the home shows that a fair portion of it is still standing after the second fire.
I think, depending on which photo they're looking at.
I'm looking at this photo, and it's exhibit.
I think it's a touch misleading. It's kind of like 90% is burned out to the walls, to the inside, if you were to flip it around.
But you can understand why this isn't a case where there's nothing left but a heap of smoldering embers, where I think you wouldn't need an expert to say this was a total loss, and probably wouldn't have an insurance company contesting that, right? I mean, this is something in between. And what about this case permitted your client to testify about the ability to safely repair this based on what was left after the second?
There's, I guess, two components, and I don't want to get those mixed. There's the total loss during instruction, and then this kind of repair actual cash value during instruction, both of which were denied. And so I can't really distinguish necessarily between the two, and of that there is an actual admission to total loss, and we never get to that issue. There's an actual admission to total loss. Total loss takes care of that issue. There is total loss, and again, the appraisal was denied. So it goes to the heap and rubble argument.
Well, where is the admission? I understand that there was a letter that was sent, I don't remember, it was before the litigation was commenced, where a statement is made by other owners. We agree the dwelling is a total loss as a result of the second fire, but maintain that it was not as a result of the first fire. So there was that letter that made a settlement offer. Then there's an answer to the complaint that seems a little bit vague. But then you followed up with specific requests for admissions that were denied. So why should we conclude that the district court erred by rejecting your argument that there had been an admission that this dwelling is a total loss?
I focus on the pleadings. The pleadings are the most important aspect, I believe, of legal document in court. That is addendum 31 to the paragraph 26, admits that the insured premises currently constitutes a total loss, just unequivocally.
No, go ahead.
Currently was at a different time than, I mean, that was 2 years down the road.
That's completely, I would say, insignificant and inaccurate statement. I think that was raised by auto owners, and the reason I think the date on that was February 6, 2017.
That everyone litigated the case like total loss or not was an issue.
I disagree. There's never a deposition, no arguments.
There was no request for admissions on your behalf. Do you admit that this was a total loss?
I said discovery.
And they denied it.
I don't. It's a very tough, they say it's, we're not clear what total loss says. I don't think that Rule 35, when you look at the answers, that they have to specifically provide evidence as to the reason and basis for the denial, or it looks at if I were to brought a motion to compel. And I don't even believe that we're not sure what total loss means and is other than otherwise denied can counteract an answer when nothing is offered. Keep in mind, no discovery is offered, no experts offered. The testimony of Mr. Bosshart is in the case where he very clearly says, we didn't do anything. We didn't protect the shelter.
The time is short, so I have one more question for you. Let's assume it's not a total loss. Do you agree that paragraph 2 on page 26 of the policy governs how the loss is settled, any loss to the dwelling, rather?
I'm sorry, I don't have that.
That's the language quoted on in the appellant's brief on page 2 under the statement of facts. Or not appellant, respondent, excuse me.
I don't know the answer to that. We litigated, there's a whole variety of sections in there that I don't think either party seemed to know at the time of trial. I try to argue that to the judge that there could be a variety of provisions that seem to come into play at that point. I guess I haven't even gotten to a variety of the other issues raised in the case. I'll briefly touch on those. Items 4 and 5 and 6.
You don't have 5 minutes to rebut.
Thank you.
Good morning, it pleases the court and counsel. I am Tim Tobin, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Auto Owners Insurance Company. And we're here today after a trial that was much more complicated than it needed to be. And the reason for that complication, unfortunately, follows us here to the Court of Appeals specifically. That is the appellant's complete inability to understand his burden of proof with regard to damages. This is a first-party insurance claim. Auto Owners did not cause the losses at issue, and it isn't a tort case. Auto Owners agreed to pay defined amounts in the event of a covered loss, and the jury question.
So also, I'll ask you the same question as I just asked appellant. If this wasn't a total loss, what provision in the or provisions in the policy governing the settlement of the losses?
Sure.
For the house?
They are found beginning essentially on page 2 and 3 of our brief, and it's in the record as trial exhibit 101, the policy is.
So I was looking at the policy, and there's also an amendatory endorsement to the policy that talks about, it says under section 1, property protection is deleted and replaced by the following, and basically in place of replacement cost, it uses functional replacement cost. Does that amendatory endorsement apply instead of the replacement cost language on page 26 of the policy?
Honestly, Your Honor, I didn't expect that question. I'm not familiar with the provision that you're talking about.
Okay, it's towards the end of the policy. It's it's
Yeah, we have, just in our...
It doesn't have a page number, it just says amendatory endorsement, how losses are settled, but it's part of, attached to the policy.
Okay, again, I'm, that's probably part of the trial record, which I didn't bring with me in total, so I don't have that handy. I got the addendum, did we put it in the addendum?
No, it's not in the addendum, there are only select pages in the addendum.
Okay.
The definition of functional replacement cost is defined to mean the cost to repair or replace damaged covered property with construction materials or methods of construction that are functionally equivalent to the original construction of the damaged property. So that also requires evidence of the cost to repair or replace the damaged covered property, but I'm just trying to clarify which provision applies.
I'm familiar with that endorsement now that you mention it, and the idea is that if building materials are no longer available, the functional equivalent of those materials will be used as opposed to the actual materials in the original construction. That's the only...
Okay.
That's the only difference, but they both use the word cost, and that is the cost to repair or replace. And that's where we run into this problem, and that is that there is, that necessary evidence is the cost to do the repair. Typically, they come in the form of building estimates by licensed contractors. But somebody with that level of experience has to be able to come to court and testify. I've never gone to...
Mr. Als, that person though, wouldn't he?
He, well...
Somebody who is qualified to in fact provide testimony on just those points?
I don't know, and the record is devoid on that. Mr. Als has been represented to be that, but there's been no offer of proof, Your Honor. On what basis can this court conclude that Mr. Els could have given that testimony? And if he does, he then falls into the category of an expert. Now, the plaintiff can be an expert on his own behalf, credibility issues aside, but the fact is that if that testimony is given by Mr. Els, that is expert testimony, and it has to be disclosed in accordance with the court order, and it was never disclosed. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even disclosed before we started the trial. The only thing that was disclosed, it was in a cryptic email, and it was some computations made by somebody who had been identified as a witness in May, and the trial's in September, in May, but was never disclosed as an expert. No information was given about the opinions that would be given.
Wasn't appellant's counsel justified in thinking that the issue of total loss had been resolved, and so there wasn't a need to notify an expert or disclose an expert, given your letter dated December 19th, where you state that the dwelling is a total loss as a result of the second fire, and then the answer as well?
First of all, those are settlement discussions, and nothing more than that. And the equivalent of that is, look, we'll consider this to be a total loss. Let's just talk about the settlement value based upon the chances that we're going to be able to prove that Mr. Els was responsible for starting the second fire. That's all that letter says. And as Judge Gutters said in this very courthouse, you know, once you go to court, once you start the lawsuit, it's game on for all of the issues. We don't have to accept that. And I think it would be a very bad precedent for this court to say that something that is said in the context of settlement negotiations in order to avoid a trial now becomes an admission for purposes of an issue that then gets tried by consent.
Just to clarify, I was also referencing the answer where auto owner stated that the insured premises currently constitutes a total loss. So I wasn't suggesting that the letter alone should be considered
An admission, a legal admission on its own. And that's what we need here, by the way, is a legal admission. We don't need an offhand comment from counsel. And first of all, did I have the authority of my client necessarily to make a legal admission on its behalf? That's the other question. But the answer...
What does it mean in the answer? In paragraph 26,
sure.
It states, auto owners admits that the insured premises currently constitutes a total loss but otherwise denies the allegations contained in paragraph 3 of the complaint, 35 of the complaint. Then I'm looking at paragraph 35 of the complaint that says, based on the second fire, the home is a total loss under the policy as the replacement cost exceeds the limits of the policy. So what are the allegations you didn't admit?
Well, what I didn't admit is that replacement cost exceeding the policy limit makes it a total loss. That's issue number one. That's not the definition
of total loss. That's not the definition of total loss.
So I'm denying that. And the other thing that I'm denying is the qualifier as a result of the second fire. We're not admitting that the property is a total loss as a result of the second fire. We're admitting that it currently constitutes what would be a total loss, that is non-repairable remnants of a fire that occurred 2 years prior. That's all that we're admitting. And honestly, this idea that constitutes an admission, look at the behavior of appellant and his attorney following that alleged admission. We served the request for admission. In May, we exchanged draft verdict forms, and those verdict forms by both parties ask for a determination of dwelling damages. There's a motion for summary judgment. How easy would it be to say they've admitted in their answer that this is a total loss? Please give us a determination as a matter of law that this is a total loss. That wasn't done. That wasn't even mentioned. As a matter of fact, that motion for summary judgment was seeking relief that said that this case will then proceed on a trial for damages only. Damages only. Well, damages were clearly something that had to be tried. We then go and look at the discussions during trial. We had innumerable discussions about total loss and what was needed to prove that and so forth. Not once was this admission ever raised. There were experts that had been prepared to testify, apparently, on what subject. I have no idea. And if I might say, I do want to, on the replacement cost and the definition of that, if I can return to that for a second. One of the cases that was cited in the reply, and I didn't have a chance to reply, obviously, and it's Wilcox versus State Farm. And that's offered in support of the so-called broad evidence rule. And I don't want the court to lose sight of the fact that Wilcox versus State Farm was a certified question in a case in which the definition of replacement or actual cash value was not defined in the policy. And the court said, and that was the certified question, which the court reframed but still included that qualifier. When the term actual cash value isn't defined in the policy, what evidence can we consider in order to make that determinant? That was the issue in Wilcox. It has absolutely nothing to do with a policy where that term is defined, which it is here. And it comes back to the cost of replacement or repair, less depreciation. And those are the elements that the plaintiff had to prove, and they knew it. To suggest that this issue of dwelling damages was somehow conceded or waived is absolute nonsense. And the idea of an admission was never raised at the trial court level. So what do we have? We have trial by consent. The other thing I want to note is the offer of proof. There's been no offer of proof as to what any of these witnesses would have testified. And with the absence of an offer of proof, the trial court, I mean, the record is not preserved in that regard. Therefore, the trial court's decision has to be affirmed, I think, additionally, on that basis.
Can I ask you then about the question of prejudgment interest?
Sure.
I think the one thing the parties agree in this case is there should be some award of prejudgment interest in the district court earned by failing to make such an award. Am I right about that? The question is how much, not to what extent there is interest available.
Yeah, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that the court erred by not. I mean, that issue was presented to it, and Judge Betters just simply...
The court didn't rule on that.
Apparently not. I don't see anything, and I think my worthy opponent would have pointed it out if there was something.
Well, I think the argument Auto Owners advances is that to the extent prejudgment interest is available, it would be available up to the stated limits of the insurance policy. I'm looking at the standard fire insurance policy, 65A01, section 3, it says the company will not in any case be liable for more than the sum insured with interest thereon from the time of the loss shall become payable. Doesn't that suggest interest is on top of whatever the stated limits are?
Under that, yes, but that language says from the date that it becomes payable. And if you look at the terms of payment under the policy, the loss isn't payable until there's been a determination of the loss. That is essentially post-judgment interest, Your Honor. And I think
what section of the policy are you referring to?
That's not in our policy, Your Honor. I believe what Judge Bjorkman is referring to is, in fact, the standard fire insurance policy. We can exceed coverage from the standard fire insurance policy, but we can't fall below that standard. So it's a good question.
And I was just trying to, your last point you said, where you were arguing that it didn't become payable, it essentially became post-judgment interest. What language are you referring to support that position? Because she was reading some specific language from the standard policy and the statute. Are you referring to language in that same standard policy?
No, yes and no. It finds itself in both the Minnesota standard fire insurance policy and our policy, and
so
that
where
is...
where in your policy are you referring to?
I didn't anticipate this issue, quite frankly, but it says that losses, if we have a dispute over the amount of a loss, it's not payable until somebody makes a determination as to that amount of loss. The case you might want to reference, age takes these sites away from me. I don't recall them as quickly as I do, but there was a recent decision, and it had to do with by your court that had to do with pre-award interest in an appraisal, and the policy did not have the language that you just cited, Judge Berkman, which is interest accumulates from the date that it is payable. And the insurance company in that case tried to argue, we get the benefit of the Minnesota standard fire insurance policy, and what that means is it's not payable until our policy says it's payable.
I found that out in your policy, and that is what your policy says.
Okay.
Either there's an agreement between the parties, or there's a court judgment or an appraisal award.
Correct. Thank you. And that's when it becomes payable. And what the statute says is that you get interest if we don't pay when we owe it, which is the equivalent of post-judgment interest. It's not pre-judgment interest. And the Lessard case controls. Can I make one point about the bifurcation, or am I okay? The thing that I wanted to say that came out of the oral argument was the idea of bifurcation. Bifurcation follows an entirely different standard than a continuance, and Judge Riley, you're absolutely correct. That would not have prevented whatever harm was caused to the plaintiff here. Judge Betters went out of his way to give the appellant the opportunity to request a continuance, and it was never requested. And it's fatal in my view. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, sir. A few key points seems to be the main concerns of this court. We haven't mentioned the denial of the appraisal and the justifiable reliance on appellant and appellant's counsel has always been, this was requested from the beginning, a request under the policy to appraise the value of the property to avoid this issue. And the argument back from counsel from Auto Owners was exactly, we don't have to, it's a total loss. So we're not going to appraise an item what we don't dispute is totally damaged that we will pay if we owe it.
Wasn't that one of several grounds stated for the denial of the appraisal? I thought that the fundamental problem is that they didn't think it was a covered loss at all because your client had set the fire.
Yes, but I don't think there's any limitation in the policy that just because they dispute the payment that an appraisal isn't appropriate. And that just also, and I think the key point, was that the appraisal is just merely there to determine the damages, which we didn't want to have that argument and fight. And Mr. Auto Owners repeatedly stated in letters, this is a total loss. We're not getting into an appraisal. It's a total loss. The letters, the admission, conversations throughout the case, this was never a word. And the difference between Fire 1 and Fire 2, I think, is it's always... The admission is clear because after the second fire, the total loss existed. That never changed between 2015 and 2017. I just want to make that point very clear, that somehow it sat there for 2 years and rotted and molded. No. And it, even the testimony in the trial was that, did Auto Owner save or preserve anything? They refused. That was the testimony of Mr. Bossart. We refused to do anything with this property. It's already shot. The water hoses froze this entire, what was left of the shell, froze it. The entire time, through the entire winter. Nothing changed, nothing was protected because of that point. Mr. Bossart testified repeatedly, we did nothing, there's nothing to do. We never presented any arguments, got any invoices, so to argue that this issue was litigated is just simply false. It was never litigated, nor was it believed to be needed to be litigated with the repeated letters and the admissions and the denial of the appraisal. It wasn't until 5 days before trial does this get raised. And I go back to this memorandum where I demand a determination of total loss on 9/23, my motion and memorandum citing all the letters, make a determination. So to argue this issue is waived under 15 is just simply not true. I had this court rule against me last month on that exact issue. When the issue is, this is the Prusmart, Tank versus Prusmart case. Your Honor, Yorkman was on that, made the decision exactly on that point that when the issue is repeatedly argued by counsel before and during trial all the way through, you cannot have an issue by implicit consent. That's just the rule. And so there is no argument that this was somehow agreed to have been litigated through the entire time. We'll go back to the summary judgment order. Even Judge Letters stated there is no issue with the losses. There's never an argument raised by Auto Owners that there was ever an issue with this house through the entire case in its reply through the summary judgment. Even in trial, the in-chambers discussion, this is when it gets raised. We're sitting ready for court in the pretrial, days before trial, and in the trial, and all of a sudden, Auto Owner says, oh, we have all these problems.
And the responses to your formal request for admissions once the litigation was commenced apprise you that, in fact, despite what had been talked about in letters and the context of settlement discussions, or even in the answer, that they were going to take issue, ultimately, the question of damage?
No. They just, their answer is, we don't even know what total loss is. I think that's utterly disingenuous. I should have perhaps gone back and brought a motion to compel and say, what in the world are you talking about? And it's interesting that Auto Owners repeats through the entire process, this is what everything means. We know our policy, we know the rules. And then when they're asked to admit that they've already admitted in a legal answer, they say, I don't know what you're talking about. So if counsel is saying, well, of course, because it's already and always been a total loss, and that essentially copy and paste answers that all the way through their entire answers to everything would have justified probably attorney's fees. But it didn't get litigated because this issue was always liability and a cooperation clause. And meaning that we were, if we win both Fire 1 and Fire 2, which happened at trial, they were going to pay in the total loss. It was never an issue to be repaired, nor was it attempted to be repaired or invoiced in any way, shape, or form. And so for an issue to be raised days before trial, and a motion to bifurcate and request, and to rely on simply the argument, well, we should have had a continuance on damages. Keep in mind that rulings happened during the day of trial, through trial, and at the end of trial that changed the position on this issue of continuance and bifurcation. Judge Betters changed his rulings throughout the trial, including the day of the testimony of Mr. Ellis, and at the last day of trial, changed his mind and all the jury instructions. Never once does Judge Betters say, nor does Auto Owners request, that the instructions should never have been given. They offered the instructions on total loss. It wasn't until the last day of trial that the rug gets pulled out and Auto Owner says, oh, directed verdict, remove the instructions. So from that standpoint, certainly a continuance on the last day of trial could have been requested, but would have been denied, perhaps. And that was already when the trial was done. So, thank you.
Thank you. The case was submitted, and we will have our decision out within 90 days.